This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Chief Vikas, we're going to be discussing meta-modernism. Kashif, great to have you on the show.
Great being here. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Pleasure is all mine. So I know that it's been a kind of conversation back and forth having me on, and I'm kind of finally glad to be able to make it here, if only for a start.
And I'm also joined here with Matthew Pegas.
Good to be here, guys.
Kashif, is your current website, is it the one you're calling it now, Meta Right?
Yeah, it is metaright.org. So that would be the current domain name.
And it was also Metafuturism.
It never was. I think I had never I never got that domain name. I once had a domain name called Metrofuturism. I never got to launching that. So
a lot of this idea, the concept of the meta, it's based on the philosopher Schelling and his attempt to explain the domain of philosophy in terms of time itself. And this is basically where those charts come in. But can you explain basically how those charts, based on Schelling's ideas, how they work, and the whole concept of the meta paradigm?
Sure. Kind of apologies. Probably it's been since not even last summer, but the summer before that, I've kind of stopped releasing charts. So it's been kind of a year and a half since I've put out any more kind of diagrams for what's going on, and I even put a pause on releasing more discussion or information about what's going on with metamodernism or metafuturism and the right. I started with the argument in early 2017 that Marx might not be the enemy that the right thinks he is. And I like to think that's a little bit about what Starkianism does too. I think there's a real issue with consumerism and consumption capitalism in late republics. It has a way of corroding, I think, the national interest, and the society becomes more individualistic, and in a bad way, and I began to kind of rethink that. Marx might be sort of a scapegoat or a kind of a boogeyman for the right to, not that I'm a communist or I would, approach Marx from the left. I would not, nor am I trying to, misrepresent or, co-opt, Marx, or kind of make him something that he's not. which I think is a kind of a vice of the right sometimes. They try to co-opt someone's message. Rather, I think that Marx made some very good predictions about what late capitalism would look like, and at the time that he put out his message, it may have led to quite a bit of competing interpretations about what he was saying. But I think, you know, it, in our current times, we can definitely say that capitalism does lead to a sort of an existential crisis, and more ambivalence about the national interest, so to speak.
And that's also a theme that I guess the postmodernists kind of picked up. I mean, I always say, I think you and I, Kashif, may be similar in this, in that we're of the right in certain respects in terms of our political views, but I think appreciate some of the thinking that both Marx, but also the postmodernists and neo-Marxists, like some of the thinking, even the Frankfurt School, some of the thinking they did on the power relations in society and how capital and consumerism plays into that. I always say I kind of moved politically to the right on a lot of issues, but at the same time kind of retained that a lot of the basic critiques of Marxism and of the postmodernists about the power hierarchy in capitalist society.
Right. This is funny. I had just come back from California in 2017. It was about March or April, and it was just a bunch of things were hitting me at once. I mean, the climate change, kind of coming back into the East and realizing, oh, this is what I had spent quite a bit of time in California, kind of forgot about the East, so to speak, and just realizing what was going on in the East Coast, how culturally, how technologically far behind we are here, and culturally, but yet how kind of corporate and banking oriented we are. I had just made my way back to Philadelphia, and just a bright idea hit me, because before that I had basically spent the spring of 2017 kind of wandering around the streets of San Francisco working on my philosophy. I was writing a ton every day, and this was I guess pre Charlottesville, so this would have been it was still pretty buzzy in the alt-right, and the external, the media was trying to figure out, who are these guys? My original kind of thesis, or my original epiphany, was postmodernism from the right. So, there was such an obsession with disproving postmodernism, it's something where, Matt, you went to a great school, and obviously a lot of time spent with in academia, and so same for myself. I was very wary of becoming an academic pariah, meaning my background, I've personally a lot of Christianity, so I've seen a lot of stuff like arguments against evolution, stuff that kind of comes from the fundamentalist sphere, where you're like, okay, I know this is not going to go far, because I grew up with that, and kind of in the same way, I kind of realized that a lot, as far as the right goes, I wanted to avoid any kind of pseudo academic arguments that are so tempting to the right, either by blindness or by some sort of a desire to be deceived. I wanted to I wanted to approach postmodernism honestly, and I concluded, you know, that there was a way postmodernism could work for the right. So, yeah.
And does that tie into metamodernism, you know, postmodernism working for the right? Or I guess my question would be, like, in what way could postmodernism work for the right, and does that tie into your theory of metamodernism as a narrative for the right?
Got you. So, around that time, kind of 2017, I was writing a lot day in and day out on Facebook, on kind of on my own. I hadn't gotten into the charts and diagrams yet. I was writing a lot about a successor to postmodernism that I called hypermodernism. And I know that now John David Ebert is writing a book on something he calls hypermodernity, and he has his whole he has a collaborator too, I think, Culkin, Brian Francis Culkin, who's based out of Boston. I was really kind of into this idea of hypermodernism, a kind of a meta theory of the hyperreal. This idea that I guess function could become you know, skeuomorphized, or it could be beyond material. I begin to see hyperreality, some of the work of Baudrillard, and in Silicon Valley, you know, like obviously I was up and close with a lot of technology companies, and one thing that always struck me is when you run into the designer, the UI designer of any corporation, of any you know, they have the phrase out there, what is it called? Like, oh, you're a feminist, you just don't know it. That was something that was used to come across in college. It was something that, you know, which people used to say a lot. In Silicon Valley, I really got to learn a lot of technologists. It could be everything from an engineer to HR, to design, to, you know, CEO. It's amazing how accessible people are. I mean, in California, in terms of, they don't think in terms of a corporate hierarchy. One thing that continually struck me while I was writing about Trump's rise and all that, you know, 2015-ish, is the designer in every company, the person that was responsible for design, they always tended to have proto-fascist beliefs. So they would look at the world based on their design instincts, and their critique of the left would always be design centric. And a lot of times, you know, they were leftists themselves. They would describe problems in society, problems in politics, problems in especially policy. They could actually turn it into a almost like a UI interface. And they would start, you know, breaking down, you know, kind of, break it down into functional elements. From functional elements, they could do aesthetic elements. And so I had to kind of, when I think back about it, I was like, you know, I should have come up with the phrase, I began to notice a pattern, and the pattern is something, it could be expressed, summed up in this expression, you're a fascist, you just don't know it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, that is the thing, is about, because it's so socially unacceptable to take those views, you sort of have to put aside label, because someone could identify as liberal because that's what's the most politically convenient, but you really have to understand their core values.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was actually camped out in a co-working space during much of my time in San Francisco, and I got to kind of, my desk mate was a designer from another company, and I mean, his his girlfriend was like borderline Antifa, and you know, he ended up voting for Trump. So, you know, his girlfriend, you know, knew it, and you know, he wasn't gonna make a big deal out of it, and you know, she, you know, I mean, obviously, it's so funny. I ran into Anita Sarkeesian one night in the Mission. These people are human beings. Once you run into them, it's funny how, well, and you know, tragic how the internet can really dehumanize people. But
who is this? Anita?
Anita Sarkeesian. I guess she was, you know, kind of a figure in Gamergate. She criticizes video games, and I guess, a lot of gamers took it the wrong way, critiquing her knowledge of gaming culture, gamer culture. Yeah. And, obviously I'm just making a parallel with, you know, this guy's girlfriend. Obviously she had very far left beliefs, but she had the wherewithal to understand that there's a difference between a caricature of a person and this person I'm seeing every day. And he's made, you know what I mean? He's made a decision.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just kind of took my experiences with him and realized, wait a minute, that's every designer. It was interesting because, I spent quite a bit of time in an actual Antifa space, not even knowing what Antifa was this was later on, probably like late 2016-ish, 2017-ish. But a lot of the design-oriented people there, who were actually just kind of, their critique of, Marxism or communism or the way the hackerspace was run, was very aesthetic. It was very design-oriented. And, yeah, it got to be something brought back with me, you know, to my conversation with kind of the alt-right figures at the time, you know, whoever was in my radar.
And that's the thing about designers is if you have an aesthetic outlook, then you're going to be much more, you're going to take a much stronger stance, like this is how things should be. Well, if you have other outlooks, then that's basically secondary, because I think what is important about that is because if your political vision is shaped on aesthetic vision, then it's much more clear what it is than, say, analyzing economic data or analyzing social trends. It's so clear and visceral.
It is, and, I've seen, you could say, quote unquote, the dark side of that too, especially, post Charlottesville, since there was a bit of a, you know, quite a bit of a purity spiral in the alt-right. And I've seen some of the negative side of, what you might call aesthetic worship. I mean, it's not uncommon, you know, it's just so used to it. I mean, it's just, I've become so, numb to it now, but I see sometimes what you might call condemnations of homosexuality or other quote-unquote unaesthetic things that I think don't come across as very respectful of human rights or human agency. And you know, you see it so commonly in the alt-right that eventually you just don't you don't think about it anymore. You know what I mean?
For sure.
Yeah. So, it's something where, you know, it's good to talk about it with you guys, but, aesthetics, I've seen, you know, there's been a bit of a purity spiral, and, I've definitely seen that side of aesthetics where, it can become a dogma, and materialism as a spiritual concept. And I think that's where the Frankfurt School kind of began. It is very important. You know, obviously we we might be consciousnesses, and things might have an appearance, but we're kind of in a conundrum. We inhabit, we're in a body. Obviously there are people that don't look like us that may need aid. Doesn't mean opening the border or looking for every quote unquote bigot on your social radar, but there's that too, there's the dark side. So
what initially got you interested in that type of dissident rights politics?
Great question. I knew this was going to come up. It's something I've been trying to answer for myself the last couple of days. I had a better answer. Maybe this is funny, but actually a couple years ago, because I was actually starting to branch off from Kurt Doolittle. He very interesting and a quirky figure who I've kind of differentiated myself from over time. In the beginning, I used to banter on his profile a lot, put my critique, and to his credit, he didn't block me. He didn't, he was very patient. I would say that probably the kind of the catalyst or the impetus to push me into sort of what you might call nation over capitalism politics was probably I left the liberal arts. I left it probably twice over. I was at Penn, and Philadelphia is a very interesting. Philadelphia is a very unique city in America. Philadelphia, it has been called, not inaccurately, it's been called the poorest big city, in America, which is actually accurate. It's not poverty in the sense of like Skid Row or people kind of, pushing shopping carts and, leading kind of a user lifestyle. It's more working poverty. It's people who simply don't have the IQ or the skills they may have been born in very unfortunate circumstances. Crack babies, so to speak. Don't know if that's the nicest term in the current age, but deindustrialization hit Philadelphia very hard, all of Pennsylvania and parts of the Midwest, and it really spent a good 20 years trying to escape, trying to make a separate identity. One thing that really impacted me was kind of the day-to-day encounters with what you might call, I guess it's not a term often used, but I guess white poverty. It's often decontextualized in the media.
A place in Philadelphia, Fishtown, which that book Coming Apart.
Yes. In fact, that's the very place I'm talking about. I used to work nights, 8 to 9 months. I worked at night in that area, and it was an area where taxi drivers don't go to in the daytime. It's just an odd area, meaning it's a confluence of races, but they segregate each other themselves from each other. There is you know, there is a white area, there is a black area, and there is a Puerto Rican area. And they even, and this is just, it's just, in retrospect, it's even tough to talk about, but each group even played separate roles in the drug trade. It's really tragic. And I began to see how capitalism can exploit basically races, you know, where they're at in different positions. And I saw the kind of opioid epidemic hit especially I guess you could say white users who without privilege, white people without privilege is a very taboo topic in the media. There are very tough articles out there. One came out after the recession around like 2009. It was in the New Republic, and lo and behold, the topic was Philadelphia, the Fishtown area. And it's a very difficult topic for the media to discuss. The reporting takes a lot of time. But I saw the opioid epidemic before it hit kind of the mainstream media. It was not good. You know, the government was flat-footed in its response. I wondered if there was some kind of racialized response involved. There was so much focus on treating everyone as the same entity. There was so much focus on equality that there was not enough focus on, I guess, specificity. There are very different reasons. If you see poverty up close in each race, there are very, very different reasons why each group ends up on the street, you know.
You were initially on the left primarily because of the economic issues, and then you said that you shifted to the right when, basically, so initially you associated the right with capitalism, and then you shifted to the right on the view of putting nation before capitalism?
Yeah, that's kind of a summary or a broad look, but I can kind of make it a little more specific. So think about it this way. I would have been in my in early 2000s, obviously I would have been more conservative, like Republican. George W. Bush had come into office, and you know, the Christian right pretty much supported him. So I didn't know any better. I was a teenager. So, you know, I don't know, capitalism, hurrah, war on terror, you know, hooray. I guess the change in me really started happening when I saw the working poor, and I began to see elements, you know, patriarchy, especially elements of patriarchy, as I began to see men kind of stuck in a system in which I guess I was not anti-patriarchal. My critique of patriarchy was not the same as the feminist critique of patriarchy. They also say things like, oh yeah, men are victims of the patriarchy, but I guess because they're not male-bodied, they may not fully understand what that means. But around 2005, I began to see capitalism as a serious threat to fundamentalist Christianity. In other words, my critique of capitalism became was fundamentalist in origin, and I began to see patriarchy as a game that that was going to seriously betray men you know, male bodies, although not in the way that, not quite in the way that feminists would say. I guess my final turn, if you're asking me at what point did I, you know, if my critique, you know, everyone begins critiquing capitalism, right? I mean, I assume was that Mussolini or Hitler or all the bad guys in history, right? They always take the dark turn. First they critique capitalism, and then they decide, oh no, that's, I'm going.
Mussolini was a Marxist first, and then transformed that into fascism. But I mean, there's socialist elements of that. So
I would also rush to add, they lived in a very different time. They lived, I believe, right in the middle of industrialization. And so you can imagine kind of some of, you know, their whole idea of science and pseudoscience to improve the state of man, and, you know, eugenics and genocide. And I mean, you can quickly imagine science going to the dark side, you know what I mean? Yeah. So science as a cult. So you know, obviously, you know, I'm 100 years later, 80 years later, but I mean, if you know, Stark, if you're asking when was my specific swing to saying, okay, I'm not Christian, but you know, in observation, but also I'm not left wing. When did that change happen? When did that switch happen? I would say it probably occurred in around 2012, and it was not my experiences with capitalism. It was not my experiences with patriarchy or capitalism or even the working poor. What really changed me was my kind of close interaction with users of heavy drugs, and the system that was in place to. This radicalizes a lot of people, and their interactions with their kind of experiences with the rehabilitation programs set up to help them. What had happened was, I was living on my own, 2013, and we had a polar vortex. Matt, I'm not sure if you were on the East Coast in 2013, but
I was. I remember that polar vortex very well.
It's something. I'll tell you, Robert. It's something. If you're on the East Coast, you won't forget it. And we're used to it.
They had one a couple weeks ago in like the Midwest, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah. The cold will. I don't know. It'll sear
it. It hurts to go outside.
Yeah. It will sear itself into your consciousness. So I remember like living downtown Center City, and people would not come out for weeks at a time. And I remember there was this 2-week stretch where it was -8, -12 every day, and the East Coast is not made culturally. I mean, we're not Maine, you know what I mean? We're not, and so we're not Maine, we're not Wisconsin, we're not Minnesota, and there would be one. 1 week, 1.5 week stretches where the wind was -20, and it was people would not actually. It's a long story. I ended up getting frostbite. I just never imagined that would happen in Philadelphia. Very like mild, not the type that. So there's two types. I ended up getting the type that your body, I guess, after summer, your body, like, I don't know, your skin becomes alive again. But you begin to see who the real homeless people were, and because obviously there are people that are So the East Coast doesn't have that kind of weather where people can just be career homeless and just chill and drift and surf or whatever. When I spent some time in San Francisco, I learned there was a whole other subculture out there. the weather's so good in California, you can make your own lifestyle. I don't know.
Yeah, pretty much.
when it became that cold in Philadelphia, I began to see who kind of was really in need of help. I had a kind of an extra property, that had come my way through a mutual friend. So a house I wasn't living in. It was off of Fishtown, but it was closer to downtown. So it was like close to the highway, close to the bridge, the Benjamin Franklin Bridge, connecting to New Jersey. So I began to, help people find housing because I guess the politics situation in the shelters was a little bit too crazy. Some of it could become racial, which is actually a separate story in this context, but believe it or not. But yeah, people were not necessarily getting the housing they needed, and some of them were functional addicts, and that's where I kind of, I guess the phenomenon that hit me that, was not well, is not well researched, even now. There is a drug culture is very, very racialized on the consumption side. Now, there's this negative stereotype. Black crime or whatever, or young black males, I don't know, drug dealers. I mean, that's a negative stereotype. But I'm talking about, it seemed as if every race was doing their own drugs. So I'm talking more on the consumption side. And if they were white and they were male or female, they were out. It was always heroin. It was always heroin. And, to be honest, the white users were always, they had the hardest drugs. And, it was either a medical issue or, some sort of, not psychosexual. I don't know. Maybe psychopathic. It was definitely something where they were questioning the validity of existence. So it involved some pretty, philosophy heavy. I met very smart people on the street.
Higher IQ addicts are actually the addicts that are the most egregious addicts and the ones who have the hardest time. Use the hardest stuff and have the least likelihood of getting better.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and even more esoteric. So you're getting from me the esoteric knowledge of the homeless situation. It seemed as if sorry for my cough. It seemed as if the Jewish population was overrepresented in among the homeless. In Philadelphia at least, I met quite a few. Yeah, I don't know how it's looking in California, but when I was in Philadelphia, there was quite a few, just high IQ people, and among them, there were Jewish Americans, I guess. So they were out here. They were out there, just kind of thinking through their stuff and taking what I remember. One young man, he was younger than me. He was from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I guess he was from one of the richest families in Mexico. And I guess his family had immigrated to America, and he was doing drugs I'd never heard of. I mean, the other homeless people would. They could not afford what he was doing. So, he was so deep into it, he gave up his very he got evicted from his very expensive apartment just so he could continue that lifestyle. And he told me a couple stories which were so intriguing. He said a couple times he had been stopped in the polar vortex by police officers, but he was never arrested because the stuff he was carrying was too exotic. They didn't know what it was, so he could pass it off as something else. So I just kind of became very very keen to the racialized element of homelessness and of drug consumption. I think with people of color, it was generally more of an issue. One of the things you'll notice is, other than crack, sorry, people of color don't do very hard drugs. I think crack was a very 90s and 80s issue. I mean, I know there's some issue with movement across the border of hard drugs, but you know, that's done by the Central American cartels. But on the user side, I think people of color, the hardest they'll go is crack. And I think with especially with the black homeless population, or don't have enough insight into any other group, it would have been more like perhaps a family. I think, as you may be well aware, again, it's a less discussed issue, but I think people of color are more cool with like multi-generational living, whereas, you know, if you're quote unquote stereotypically Caucasian, I think self-sufficiency, stoicism, you know, you got to find your own apartment.
Yeah. To speak to that, I've heard it said before that white people tend to live through their children a lot less than almost any other race. Yeah. You know, there's more of a sense of you leave the nest, you do your own thing, less of, making your children your everything and, like, projecting your success onto how successful they are. I mean, I don't know about for African Americans, but certainly for immigrant populations, that's at least the cliche, is that you have kind of more multi-generational, like, okay, I'm going to make my life better for my children. Whereas with white people in the current era, and obviously white people were immigrants too, or many white people were immigrants too at a certain point, and they might have been more like that. But for well-established, you know, white Americans, there's much less of a sense of that multi-generational aspect. It's a lot more, I mean, it's part of atomization on the one hand. It's a lot more like you just find your way in the world.
Yeah. I wonder if, right, because a lot of times, you know, if they were black and homeless, to be honest, it may have had to do with, literally, it was almost like a family dispute. You know what I mean? Yeah, either like, meaning, you know, I just don't get along with my cousin or my aunt and uncle or whoever other whoever owns the house or whatever, or, you know, I, or, you know, they might have, been in jail for long periods of time and lost all their social connections or whatever. It was almost always social for people of color, meaning social. Well, not that it wasn't, you know, broadly social, everything social, but yeah, it's it makes me wonder, you know, what if, because I mean, so I guess you know, I'm a big fan of me and my whole family are big fans of like black and white movies, and so you know, we kind of, especially like growing up, like, you know, if you're exposed to like fundamentalist Christianity, they pretty much are only cool with pop culture from the 50s, you know, so we consumed lots and lots of classic movies, so you see more of a high trust culture. I wonder, yeah, if I it just makes me wonder if perhaps it's just several decades of exposure to capitalism, to low trust capitalism.
You would say it's primarily capitalism that's creating this hyper atomized society?
Well, I have to confess, I've been spending the last few months around a lot of new Marxists. So maybe I'm picking up
some. Yeah. Oh, I was just gonna say I agree. I mean, I've learned a lot from, you know, like the alt-right and stuff. I think there's a lot to learn there about whatever you want to say, like the ill effects of multiculturalism. But I think fundamentally I do still see capitalism as the biggest creator of a lot of these issues. And I, too, spent a lot of time around New Marxists. So it's...
As far as aesthetics go, how do aesthetic preferences reflect the preferences of a different political ideologies?
It seems as if I kind of you're kind of broaching something really big here, and something I spent quite a bit of time on, about a year. But you're basically making a distinction between the left and the right's aesthetic preferences, right?
Oh, right.
Right. Okay, that's fine. This is weird. That actually is kind of how I was originally parsing the alt-right. So my impression is that the left and the right actually perceive irony in separate ways. And I think with the left, what they see as irony is juxtaposition. They're very big on juxtaposition. Think of collage, pastiche, the avant-garde. It's big on juxtaposition. Even if you think of postmodernism and postmodern art, like graffiti. All of the early French New Wave, it's all juxtaposition. Actually, if you think about it, all of synthwave actually, you know, it's more right wing now, but it came out of French New Wave, which is all juxtaposition.
So basically, the aesthetic of the meta right.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that's just the aesthetic of the meta right? Just kind of retrofuturistic in general.
Yeah, it would be for the meta right, and I think for the broader right, the meta right just basically explicitly states it. For the right wing, irony comes in the form of self reference. So if you have juxtaposition on the right, or kind of aesthetic discontinuity, if you have juxtaposition on the left and sort of this aesthetic discontinuity, where, you know, they can kind of make a mess and call it art, you know, and the right comes along and is completely disgusted and discombobulated and even borderline, you know, nauseated, triggered, so to speak. I think for the right, self-symmetry or self-reference is paramount, and that's their conception of art or aesthetic. And I think that that's basically what's taken over future retro wave or new wave synth wave. You think? I mean, what's your thought on that?
Well, basically, the idea of what was retrofuturism and retro politics, they go hand in hand, because retrofuturism as an aesthetic is basically saying that we're going in the wrong direction, but just going backwards to the past and being a reactionary is not a path either. And it's so basically, you can take the aesthetic towards politics if you think about time. And breaking up, like, think of two branches, and I guess it's going forward in the direction you're going, and then going back, and then going back, and then making a detour in the other direction is kind of like the parallels between retrofuturism and retro politics, because you're accepting that you're not going in the right direction, but you also accept that just being a reactionary and going back in time is not a path either.
Right. So kind of the right, especially because I think synthwave has been basically taken over by right-wing aesthetics, by self-reference. What you're saying is, like, the right realizes, hey, you can't return to the past materially, so we can only return to the past aesthetically, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not so much not necessarily returning to the past aesthetically, because you're creating a new aesthetic that uses, I guess, takes into account, it borrows from things from the past. So you see that with the synthwave aesthetics and of the fusion of futurism and the Roman bust, and that's just one example, but there's just kind of in that general direction and interest in retrofuturism, because it's not so much it's not about creating a carbon copy of the aesthetics of the past.
Right. They're almost like well, I had a professor in English once who used to say new wine in an old bottle, right? So it's something old in a new way, right? So I think to be honest, that relates very much to the rights. I think that relates very much to the right's conception of time, which is cyclical. No, linear time would be more discontinuous, and that's why you see kind of the material mess kind of in modern art, and you know, basically juxtaposition. So, I mean, I think that in many ways, the right's emphasis on modern art, on retrowave is basically their love for cyclical time.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know if I'd classify, you know, the entire right that way, but there's definitely a trend or a thread in the alt-right. Definitely the followers of Julius Evola and those interested in that kind of esoteric stuff, where I think that makes a lot of sense that they certainly do. Actually, no, this goes broader because you have Julius, people who follow like Julius Evola, Oswald Spengler. These were people, and also some kind of more esoteric figures like Yeats, the poet W.B. Yeats. They were all these nationalists who had this cyclical view of time, which they maybe borrowed from Hindu philosophy or whatever. But then you also have more mainstream figures like Steve Bannon. I haven't seen much of his work, but there was this idea that in his documentaries he presents this view of history as in a constant cycle. So I guess I do think there's something to that a view of history as cyclical is characteristic, if not to the right generally, than to a certain thread of sort of crypto-fascist or proto-fascist thinking. And certainly I think that fits in with the aesthetics of vaporwave, what have you, retrofuturism, this idea of past and future meeting in this kind of endless loop.
Yeah. Yeah, this sort of endless self-referencing loop, or what I would call like a recursive loop. I was going to mention that we used to call, so meta right, the name is, for a long time, this idea, went without a name. We used to call it the aesthetic right. That's what it was called. It used to be, they say the super chat killed the alt-right. There's a lot of discussion on that, but the super chat made the meta right. We used to have a super chat, and the super chat was called the aesthetic right. So it went on for a good year and a half until the group was formed.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Kashif, do you have any upcoming projects you want to talk about?
Sure. What? I can't point to anything, anything big, any one thing. But what I can say is, I'm actually working on an idea of linear time, a theory of linear time. I think it's very important for the right to be able to kind of figure out. I've done a lot of work on cyclical time now. You know, kind of what scientists would call emergent time, future, you know, future time, future past. I'm working on an idea right now on linear time. If only for this very reason, I want to be able to have civil conversations with people who disagree with me politically. They simply prefer a linguistic frame of reality in contrast to an aesthetic frame. So just to kind of reach out to them and to, you know, say, hey, I understand your way of life. It's different from mine. I am working on an idea of linear time. Again, it's kind of springs from Hinduism in the same way that kind of like my idea of hyper-realism or hyper-modernism came out of Hinduism. The idea, it doesn't have, you know, the meta-right did not start out with the meta-right did not start out with a cut-and-dry name. We had all types of names for aesthetic right. So I don't have the most slick name for it, the most cut and dry name, but right now the term for it I'm using is scientific fatalism. So that's kind of the idea I'm working with in terms of a theory of linear time.
Kashif Vikas, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you so much.
And also, thank you, Matt.